The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Research office here at the school. And our office, as most of you know, as some of you know at least, provides legal research assistance to international criminal courts and tribunals, including the International Criminal Court, the ICC, on issues of international criminal law and international humanitarian law. The discussion we are about to have today is extremely timely, of course, thanks to Eleanor's putting it together. As most of you know, earlier this month, the ICC issued a warrant of arrest for the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir. The prosecutor of the ICC had originally requested the warrant in July of last year, July 2008, alleging that Bashir was responsible for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide in Darfur. After nearly 9 months, the longest it's ever taken the court to decide on an arrest warrant, the court finally issued its decision, granting the arrest warrant for crimes against humanity and war crimes, but not for genocide. In light of the low standard required for the issuance of an arrest warrant, and the standard is that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the suspect was responsible for the crime charged, the prosecutor appealed the decision of the court and basically argued that the judges applied a higher threshold of evidentiary proof than is required at this stage of the proceedings. Now, this is the first arrest warrant issued by the court against the sitting head of the state. It comes, interestingly enough, less than a month after the government of Sudan and the rebel group JEM, Justice and Equality Movement, signed a pact allegedly paving the way for broader peace talks aimed at ending the six-year conflict in Darfur, which the UN estimates has killed about 300,000 people and left over 2.2 million people displaced. Not surprisingly, perhaps, it has engendered a significant amount of debate on whether it represents a step forward or a step back in securing peace, justice, and security for the Darfuri people. Indeed, while some states, including, interestingly enough, the U.S., which is not a state party to the Rome Statute of the ICC, has expressed support for the ICC's efforts to prosecute those allegedly alleged to have committed atrocities in Darfur, other states have called on the UN Security Council to exercise a power under the Rome Statute that allows it to ask the ICC to defer its investigation and prosecution of the case against al-Bashir. And these states have argued that the case, pursuing the case, would actually escalate or might provoke further violence and instability. We're fortunate to have with us today a very distinguished panel of speakers who will speak to us about the implications of the arrest warrant from various perspectives, including the response of Darfuri refugees to the warrant, the views of states, and others. I'm going to introduce them to you briefly and then turn over the discussion to them. We'll have a few minutes of remarks by each panelist, and then we'll turn it over for questions and answers. So first, we will hear from our very own Professor Diane Ortlegger, who is co-director of the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law, and original founder and faculty director of my office, the War Crimes Research Office. She's published extensively on states' obligations under international law to provide effective responses to violations, to states, to serious violations of human rights and humanitarian law. In 2004, she was appointed by then Secretary General Kofi Annan as an independent expert on combating impunity. She sits on the board of various organizations, including the Open Society Justice Initiative and our own National Institute of Military Justice, and is a frequent commentator on TV and in the print media on issues related to war crimes and transitional justice. Next, we will hear from Rahim Sabir, who is project leader of a new initiative at Human Rights Watch, the New Civilian Protection Initiative. In 2004, he was one of the first human rights monitors on the ground in Darfur for the United Nations. He led a team of human rights observers in Darfur, conducting field research into human rights violations in the greater Darfur region. He conducted trainings for over 100 human rights activists and lawyers in Darfur on human rights instruments and techniques for monitoring, documenting, and reporting and human rights abuses, and it led to the first documented report on systematic rape in Darfur drafted by local human rights NGOs. Last but not least, we will hear from Nimat Ahmadi, who is the Darfuri liaison officer of the Save Darfur Coalition. She's a native of North Darfur and has promoted cooperation between the coalition and the Darfuri diaspora in the United States and abroad, focusing in particular on the role of Darfuri women in the peace process. She's a founding member of the Darfuri Leaders Network, a coalition of more than 20 domestic Darfuri organizations working to promote peace and security in Darfur. So with that, let me turn it over to Professor Orr.
Okay. Thank you so much. You know, as a professor here, it's gratifying to see so many students in the audience. We look forward to moments generally when we can help learn about what we teach in the classroom by discussing the story behind the headlines. Although I have to say, on this particular occasion, this teachable moment comes in many ways as an unwelcome opportunity because the crisis provoked by the arrest warrant and by the crisis that's been going on for years now in Darfur is so heartbreaking. On the other hand, one of the lessons that those of us who work with tribunals have discovered over and over again is that it takes the committed concern of people like you to confront the serious challenges we're going to talk about today. So I was asked to first begin by just sort of laying out what the legal obligations are that surround the issuance of the arrest warrant last week, or I guess it was now a couple of weeks ago, by the pretrial chamber. And then I want to sort of shift gears and talk about briefly about the practical challenges that confront states that have a legal obligation or just simply may wish to support the apprehension arrest. But I'm going to kind of then bounce that ball to my colleagues who are much more expert in talking about the practical dynamics surrounding this particular challenge. First of all, very briefly, there are two different categories of states that have a legal obligation to arrest Bashir should they have the opportunity to do so. One category is states that are parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. By being parties to the statute, they've agreed in very, very specific provisions of the Rome Statute that they will comply with arrest orders. And for obvious reasons, that obligation falls particularly to states in whose territory a suspect may be found. Right now, that state is Sudan. Sudan is not a state party to the Rome Statute. It is nonetheless an unwilling subject of a legal obligation that comes from a different source. The UN Security Council, as you all know, referred the Darfur situation almost exactly 3 years ago. I think it was March 31st, 2005. It referred the Darfur situation to the prosecutor in the exercise of its own extraordinary powers under the UN Charter. And under the provision it used, the Security Council issued a legally binding obligation on Sudan to cooperate fully with the International Criminal Court. And it directed that requirement to all parties to the conflict in Sudan. As we'll hear about more later, the government of Sudan has been anything but cooperative, particularly since the prosecutor issued his first arrest warrants, I think it was in May 2008, against two other people from Sudan. July. Okay. So that's sort of legally the landscape. The Security Council also requested other states to cooperate. It acknowledged in its resolution referring the situation to the prosecutor that states that aren't parties to the Rome Statute, and that includes the United States, are not legally bound to comply with its requests, including a request for surrender, but urged them to do so nonetheless. excuse me, I'm so sorry. As my students know, my allergies tend to kick up whenever I get near a microphone or a telephone. There's one particular wrinkle on the arrest warrant, the legal landscape, which I want to just mention briefly. There's a challenge that in many ways was kind of not resolved in the Rome Statute, and that concerns the arrest of heads of state and other people who may be entitled to immunities under international law. So the Rome Statute itself says in one provision that the fact that someone is a head of state or holds any other government office, no matter what it is cannot claim that status to avoid criminal responsibility. So what that means is the ICC itself doesn't have to worry about the legal status of someone in exercising its own jurisdiction once it gets the person, right? So first it has to get the person. There's a problem, though, which is that it can only rely on states to execute arrest warrants. It doesn't have its own police force. It has to rely on states. And states are subject to their own obligations under international law to respect the immunities of certain officials of foreign states. And one area in which international law has particularly strong immunities relates to incumbent heads of state. So I won't get into the technical nuances of this, but there's a provision in the Rome Statute that kind of kicks this can down the road and says that states, the upshot, I'm trying to figure out a simple way to do this without getting into the complexities, but basically I think the upshot is that while states that are parties to the Rome Statute have agreed in advance that they won't claim immunities of their own officials should they end up in the dock, they are not, states parties to the Rome Statute, are not, for obvious reasons, able to kind of waive the immunities of someone who's not a state party. So what happens if an official of a country that's not a state party is indicted, comes to their country? Can they arrest that person? They're under an obligation themselves to cooperate with arrest warrants. They're under that obligation because they're a party to the Rome Statute. The other country whose official is traveling to their land isn't subject, has not agreed to waive their own official immunities. What are you going to do? And so the provision that kind of kicks this down the road is it's a provision that basically says that when arresting an official from a third party, states have to do this in accordance with their other obligations under international law, and that the International Criminal Court will kind of resolve those issues of immunity. So there's this big question about how that would work if Bashir were traveling to the territory of a state party that's under an obligation to arrest him. Can they disregard the fact that he's an incumbent head of state, given that he's not himself, his country isn't a party to the Rome Statute? The Security Council might be able to deal with that by saying that immunities don't apply to Bashir. It didn't explicitly say anything to that effect, and for fairly obvious reasons. At the time it referred the case to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, it didn't prejudge who was going to be indicted. It shouldn't have anticipated that specific people would be indicted. It did, however, as I mentioned earlier, impose a legally binding obligation on Sudan to cooperate fully with the International Criminal Court. And so there's some speculation that maybe that those words in the Security Council resolution from 3 years ago might in effect overcome the immunities that Bashir could assert. So I just mention that because as complicated as the arrest already is, it's also complicated by the law, not just by the practicalities, and the practicalities are pretty pretty formidable. Let me turn sort of backward now and mention a few historic situations which don't present the same challenges. Every situation is different, but which presented their own challenges, and they were challenges that at the time seemed insurmountable. And they all involved situations where an incumbent leader was indicted by an international criminal court. The first one was actually an indictment of someone who was not a head of state, but was a leader of Bosnian Serbs who were at that time engaged in armed conflict in the state of Bosnia. And it was during, in the course of that conflict, that violence that came to be known as ethnic cleansing was gripping people in the same way, I was about to say in the same way that the plight in Darfur is now seizing our conscience. In some ways, though, the Bosnian tragedy held the headlines a little bit more consistently, at least at the height of the conflict. One problem with the Darfur violence is that it's gone on so long, it's hard to keep it in the headlines. But in any case, Karadzic was indicted while the violence was in full sway. And he was also at that time leading peace negotiations to end that violence. And so there was a dilemma, which I think we'll hear more about from other panelists today. How do you reconcile the claims of peace with those of justice? And the dilemma is different in every situation, but it also has very common patterns. And typically, the sort of paradigm is the paradigmatic challenge is that someone's indicted who's committed or alleged to have committed and to bear serious responsibility for horrific atrocities, and yet that's the person you're trying to negotiate with to end the conflict. And are you going to insist on accountability and give him an incentive maybe to stay in power, or are you going to negotiate, et cetera, et cetera. In the case of Karadzic, as soon as he was indicted by the International Criminal Court, those concerns were voiced. To sort of make a long story short, what happened was that as a result of his indictment, at a time when there were concerns about immunity, he was sidelined from participating in peace negotiations in Dayton, Ohio, which actually did end up leading to a peace agreement which ended the conflict in Bosnia. And so in that particular case, the very fact that he was indicted may have opened the way to a peace settlement. Fast forward a few years, Slobodan Milosevic, then the president of Yugoslavia, was indicted again in the midst of a conflict. And this time the conflict was the NATO war with Yugoslavia over atrocities then underway in Kosovo. And again, there was a lot of concern within the diplomatic community that this indictment by the International Criminal Tribunal would make it impossible for Milosevic to agree to a peace agreement to end the conflict in Kosovo. It had the opposite effect. The conflict had been underway for months, and quite soon after he was indicted, Milosevic agreed to all of the terms of surrender of NATO, and a few years later was surrendered, or less than a few years later, couple of years later, was surrendered to the ICTY. He died before his trial was completed, but he faced justice in The Hague. Finally, another court, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, indicted Charles Taylor when he was the incumbent president of Liberia. The indictment was unveiled when he was traveling to Ghana to participate in peace negotiations to end the conflict then underway in Liberia. So again, the same story. I don't even need to repeat the dilemma now. It's the same paradigm. What ultimately happened with Taylor was somewhat similar to what happened to Milosevic. The indictment contributed to discrediting him. He was given asylum in Nigeria, and please understand I'm making all of these very complex situations simpler than they really were. But one of the critical factors that led to his eventual surrender to the Special Court for Sierra Leone, where he is now on trial, was that human rights lawyers in Nigeria were exceedingly and very impressively active in pressing legal arguments, which were the form that their protests took, against his having asylum in Nigeria. Ultimately, when there was a democratic transition in Liberia, the president of Liberia requested that he be sent back there and then arranged for him to be transferred to The Hague for trial. Now, I wanted to end on that note. First of all, what I'm obviously suggesting is that at least in our past experience, we have some reason to know that it's possible to meet these challenges, even when they seem horrifically insurmountable. But I also wanted to end by noting the really important role of activists. And this was a critical factor in all three of the examples that I mentioned. In the case of Milosevic, there were a lot of NGOs all over the world who were pressing governments with influence over Serbia very, very actively, ensuring that the United States government and the European Union were applying very strong conditions for Serbia, first of all, to get aid and then to gain admission to the European Union. And the conditions included surrendering indicted suspects. It was a concerted lobby effort. And in the case of Nigeria, the fact that African lawyers were on the front lines in pressing for his surrender, I thought was quite critical to the successful outcome of that particular challenge. So I'm going to end here and turn it over.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll hear next from
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to limit myself to a couple of points and welcome any questions as you might have. The first one is about the criticism of this issuance of the arrest warrant, and even before that, of the Ocampo's decision to go after Bashir, and also the fears that that are out there in terms of the issuance of the warrant arrest. And then move to talk about the reaction in Sudan by the Sudanese government, and a little bit about what we can expect from the government of Sudan. And the third point would deal with the Arab world and how the NGOs are reacting to this, why, how the Arab League is reacting to it, and also how divided is the Arab countries in terms of of this decision. The first one, and I'm going to limit myself to two people that have tremendous weight because they both worked in Sudan, One is Ian Pronk, who is the SRSG in Sudan. And the other one is the head of the former judge, and he was the head of the commission that investigated the cases in Sudan in 2005. And they are the ones that ended up drafting the report for the Secretary General, and based on which Ocampo, the referral occurred, and Ocampo started his investigation. Both of them were critical. Pronk felt told a Dutch radio that that Ocampo had 52 names that he could have started from the bottom and then moved to the top rather than go directly to the top, and that that's going to somewhat jeopardize the humanitarian work in Sudan. Kasesi was also very critical. When in July Ocampo decided to indict Bashir, those are extremely powerful people. They know Sudan, they have worked in Sudan, but they also are lending a lot of weight to the criticism that is being heard when it comes to the issuance of this arrest warrant. Their argument can make sense, but there are also it's also faulty in a lot of ways, because unless you can show people on the ground in Darfur that have been in camps since 2003 that there is something occurring in the international, that the pressure is having an impact, you're not going to move politically in the right direction. The fears that we have, that at least the human rights international community has now, is about whether this is going to strengthen the ICC or weaken it, in the sense that if Bashir started traveling left and right without any country making at least an attempt to arrest him, that will be problematic. That will definitely weaken the ICC and the warrant arrest and so on. So where the hope is that we can keep him grounded and make sure that he's not going to travel anywhere. France has already said that they will arrest him if he travels by their skies. Then they retracted and said no. If he comes to France, he will be arrested. We'll see. He is making it clear that he's going to be traveling to a meeting in Qatar of the Arab League by the end of this month. Whether he's going to go or not, we don't know, but hopefully he won't go. And if we can make a lot of noise and make it hard for him to leave the country, then it's great for the ICC. The reaction by the government of Sudan has been extremely erratic. They are very defiant. Bashir has been traveling to Darfur, gathering Arab tribes there, showing that he doesn't care about the international community, making statements ranging from those are former colonizers to statements about international justice and Gaza and why aren't you going after Israel and the crimes committed in Gaza, making a lot of noise. But the reaction within Sudan has been somewhat subdued. There are political parties that are keeping quiet, including the government of southern Sudan. They're not saying much, with the exception of a couple of their parliamentarians, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs and Ghazi Slimane, another parliamentarian. They both came in support of Bashir and spoke against the issuance of the warrant arrest. The SPLM was not happy with that, and they made a statement that the two went out of what was agreed within the SPLM, that they shouldn't have spoken out about this. Political parties are calling for some, including one of the largest parties, the Ummah party. They were calling for a hybrid court that will have Sudanese and non-Sudanese judges and can judge them inside Sudan. So they are not going out of their way to support Bashir in this. what to expect. So far, there are two things that can be expected, given the reaction of the government. One is that the CPA and the election, the upcoming elections this year, as well as the concerns that are out there in the relationship between the Congress Party and of Bashir and the government of Southern Sudan, are going to move forward. He has to show that, and he also needs, from a pragmatic point of view, he needs the support of the government of Southern Sudan. If he starts to renege on the obligation of the Congress Party toward the government of Southern Sudan, he's going to be toast. He's going to lose the support within the country. So he has to move forward in the right direction when it comes to CPA and showing that he's doing something. And I think that just like a day or two ago, they have made some agreements about four laws that that they couldn't agree on when it comes to demarcation, north-south, and other laws establishing a national human rights commission and so on. So there is a movement with the government of Southern Sudan, where he's being extremely defiant, and I don't think that he's going to move in the right direction, is in Darfur. And it is a way of basically telling Ocampo, telling the international community, to hell with you. And you can see it by the current government asking 13 international humanitarian NGOs to leave the country. These NGOs have been providing almost 50 to 70% of the humanitarian aid to Darfur. He is also talking about the Sudanization of humanitarian aid to Darfurians, which is just a slogan. It can't happen. So these are where things are going to go in Sudan, in terms of what can be expected in the coming year or so. The reaction in the Arab world has been very much divided. The NGOs have done a great job. The human rights organizations, it's led by an organization in Cairo called the Center for Human Rights Studies that has built a coalition and gone after Bashir and the Congress Party, supported the decision, Ocampo's decision in July, and supported now the issuance of the arrest warrant. The Arab League, as a body of Arab states, is divided. There are countries that are within the Arab League that have been vocal and supportive of the Congress Party and of Sudan, of Bashir, including Egypt, Algeria, Libya. The Gulf states are keeping quiet. They're not saying much. Saudi Arabia has been extremely vocal against the government of Bashir. And it has a lot to do with this government hosting bin Laden in the 1980s. So they are not happy with him. And they are saying, no, yes, accountability, we are for it. When Ocampo issued his indictment in July, Amr Moussa traveled to Sudan and had a plan. And the plan basically said, let's start on finding a solution, a quick solution to Darfur, and then we can have an impact on going to lobby for Article 16 in order with the Security Council in order to postpone the decision for 1 year at the UN. He was not well received in Sudan. He is now totally keeping quiet. He almost was here last week speaking at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and it was not something that he wanted to talk about. He was not happy with the reaction by Sudan. He felt that he could have done more last July not to get to this point, but they haven't. So this is where things are right now. The Arab League and the African Union were supposed to be this week in New York lobbying for Article 16. So far, they have not agreed on what platform they are going to lobby. They haven't been hearing any positive signals from the Security Council members. So things are not going where you would hope that things would. Okay. I'm going to stop here.
Well, we have a limited amount of time. I do want to save some time for questions and answers, but thank you so much for your insightful comments. Last but not least, let's turn it over to the amount of bodies, please.
Thank you so much for your time and for giving me this opportunity to share with you the current situation and the challenges that are going on in Darfur. Actually, the indictment of al-Bashir brought a lot of controversy, but I will just try to make it very simple and everyone from you can be able to judge and see what should be done for Darfur. Since the year of 2001, and I'm saying 2001, I'm from Darfur, and I have been forced to leave my country in the year of 2005. This is the time that all Darfur was destroyed. The government in the year of 2001 and 2 was mobilizing a militia of Janjaweed and recruiting them, paying them money, equipped them, fighting alongside with the Sudanese army, and the bombardment from the air is destroying villages, killing people. Women are repeatedly being raped. They are raped during the attack while they are fleeing home, and when they end up living in the internal displaced camps. In the year of 2004, al-Bashir came to al-Fashir and said, kill them all, in a public speech. In al-Fashir, in the head of the state, and in the building, he was speaking to the public. Part of his speech was directed to the Sudan Armed Force, that killed them all. I don't want you to come back with war prisoner or injured person. This was like confirm his intention toward eliminating or exterminating Darfur people. This situation continued until today. Before, in the year of 2004, the first people who came to conclusion that this issue needs external intervention, because the responsibility to protect is responsibility for the government against for its people. But our government was killing us. So that is not the case. African Union came in, and they brought their troops to protect the people of Darfur. But the troop was failure because of the reluctant and continuous obstruction from the side of Sudan government. And again, they went back and came to conclusion that they need more than just African Union. They need UN troops down there. And they issued the resolution. And while they are getting the troop, also the obstruction and reluctant and undermining the authority of the UN Security Council continue to be bad. During all of this time, therefore, he continued to be killed. Nothing has changed. And again, the UN Security Council, they were unable to protect the people of Darfur. There was a peace negotiation that negotiated in Abuja and ended up with signing the peace agreement, which is DPA, Darfur Peace Agreement. But it was failure. It was violated in the same day and the next day by the two signatories, and the government was the first one to violate that peace agreement. Until today, they have peace agreement that they say, we have this peace agreement for Darfur, but none of the things that put in place that was implemented. Then the case of Darfur was referred to the ICC, as my colleague here mentioned, to the International Criminal Court by the UN Security Council. Why they refer it? Because they get to convince that this type of regime and this crime committed are beyond the capacity of the UN itself, because they're trying to bring peace peacekeeper there to protect the people, but people are still dying, and the peacekeeper themselves are still attacked by the government forces and other forces there. Then when the case is fair, the court has to do the job. They did the job perfectly, and they brought all of the evidence, and they decided to issue an arrest for two low-level official, like the Janjaweed leader, who is Ali Kosheb, and Ahmed Haroun, who was a former Minister of Interior and who was responsible for the crime committed in Darfur. And that was a good start for pursuing peace. At least they know that high-level official implicated in this crime in Darfur. But the court, maybe at that time, I'm not sure, but I think at that time they started from the bottom, at least to allow the chance for the peace process. But because the Sudan government, the al-Bashir government, they don't have commitment to whatever they said or agreed on, either verbal or written commitment, they continue to violate all agreements between them and the international community, between them and other Sudanese, until today. And later on, when the violence continued, the court continued its investigation, and they came to conclusion that by evidence, al-Bashir is the first person who is responsible for the crime committed in Darfur. And the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Luis Marino Ocampo, submitted an application for the arrest warrant. And at that time, so many countries supported the application, but some other countries are trying to find a way to call for deferral, but no one stepped in to propose a resolution for Article 16 to suspend or delay the arrest warrant for 1 year, as they are claiming. And there was a lot of practitioners and academics who argued that this decision, if it came out, it will jeopardize efforts for peace process. But for me and for the Darfuri people who are victimized several times, and for the Sudanese people who have suffered from immunity along the way, like, it's not only this time. This government has 20 years killing people. Before that, immunity in Sudan is chronic. At least in the time I lived myself, I have never saw a president that came to power without killing people. That is why al-Bashir felt that there is no accountability. They can kill all of that white people and they can just escape with immunity. Then now, people are arguing that this is like jeopardize the peace process. There's no peace, no existing peace actually. While people are dying, suffering, killing, and raping, looting are continuing day and night. Even they ended up recently attacking the helpless, displaced people in their camps. So within this situation, where is peace? Like, they haven't asked themselves, what does peace mean to women like myself, who are still hanging on in the internal displaced camp and refugees camp? They are repeatedly being raped day and night. What does peace mean to those children who lost their parents? What does peace mean to those whom removed from their land, and there is new settler already occupies that land? So peace is not just the absence of war, but peace has a lot to do with the situation like what is going on now in Darfur. So to have peace in Darfur, I don't think without proper justice there will be peace. And peace, people have to notice that. We don't have to argue that justice will jeopardize peace. Like, traditionally, people are speaking about peace, and most likely peace is compromise. Yes, we know that. But I don't think people should work for peace at forcing people, like by force, to compromise their own right to live as human being or to live in dignity. And in the case of Darfur, we have, before the DPA, there is a CPA there, and everybody knows the Comprehensive Peace Agreement is not going well, but people trying, like the National Unity Government, at least the SPLM from their side, they are trying to do whatever possible not to go back to war. But if they are following al-Bashir's steps, they will immediately go back to war. This is This is exactly what is going on now in Sudan. So what is peace there? There is no peace agreement in that four people are dying. There is no peace negotiation. And even if, like, the indictment of al-Bashir, people thinking of this is the government that we need to negotiate peace with them. For me, the government should not be an individual official. The government is system. Sudan has national unity government. If people are serious to make peace, indictment of al-Bashir will not jeopardize peace in Sudan. And given the case of the CPA, if peace is important for just individual or supposed to be safeguarded by individual, I think Victor Garang is the most important part of the CPA. He passed away, but Southern Sudanese remain committed to peace agreement. And that, I think, the clear presence and evidence, people should follow that step. The indictment of al-Bashir will not jeopardize. Sudanese people are the good people, and they themselves, we all can work together and bring peace to Darfur and Sudan in general. So I don't think Darfur unanimously supported the decision by the International Criminal Court. And we believe that without justice, because the person who perpetrated crime against you, and tomorrow he's the one supposed to be responsible for implementing the peace agreement that can bring respect for dignity of your life or allow you to live as equal citizen. That cannot happen in the case of al-Bashir. And there is, my colleague mentioned about the case of Arab League and African Union. That is a false argument from the African Union, I think, because Africa as the first people get into Darfur, but they failed to do so, because peacekeepers are now not protecting Darfur. And they themselves are set by al-Bashir. But because of the pan-Africanism and trying to make it like a collective position, but that is not true. We are African. And we are African victim. If the court doing something, it's protecting us as African victim. It's not Western victim. We are not from the country where the court came. And the court has nothing to do with Sudan unless refer the case by the UN Security Council. That is why I think Sudan is member state of the UN, United Nations at least. And all countries that member state of the UN Security Council, even if they are not member state of the ICC, they have the obligation to stand firm and support the court to proceed, because they are the one who came and decided to refer the case of Sudan. They cannot come back and undo their own decision unless there is. And why we believe in this ICC process, because we have witnessed several attempts for bringing peace to Darfur. We're just waiting for a paper to be signed that can bring security to our people. Our only ambition is that to have security in place, but that never happened. So what, like, you yourself, you can judge and can say, while you have your people dying, and you are dying day and night, and there's nothing changed. So do you expect that al-Bashir, if he given one year, will bring peace to Sudan? And he knows that there is arrest warrant that pending for 1 year waiting for, like, we were talking to people from inside Sudan, and the women in the internal display come saying, he haven't given us one day or 1 hour. We are still suffering here. Why should people think of giving him 1 year? So that is the situation. Thank you.
The debate about peace and justice can take place at a level of incredibly high distance from the suffering in Darfur, and in terms of breaking through all of the reasons not to do something, which is so important. So thank you for being here, and I know it's a lot of work for you, but it makes a difference. It's an honor to be on the panel.
Thank you, Ben. I'll open it up now for questions. and direct your question to a panelist or the entire panel. Yes.
I guess I got a question for the entire panel. I think one thing I heard about this issue was why, I don't know if you guys mentioned it already, I apologize. But I heard that why didn't the ICC wait until the president leaves international waters? Why did they announce it, you know, publicly, where he's able to stay in the country, you know, hide or, you know, travel amongst Sudan and not ever leave Sudan at all? But why didn't they just, like, you know, wait till he leaves the country, arrest him, and then, you know, issue him his arrest warrant and stuff like that? Or would that, like, cause trouble?
Do you want
to? Sorry. The court is a judicial body. It's not a political body. It's not supposed to be a political body to take politics into account. So they have to make a decision based on evidence that they have. And they have to make decisions the same way they have made decisions in the past. So if a company conducted an investigation since 2005, for almost a little bit more than 3 years, and sent his evidence to the panel of three judges, they conducted their own investigation into the evidence that Ocampo sent them, and they say right then that it's going to be around 3 months to issue a decision whether support the evidence that was sent to them by the Ocampo or not. And that's what they did. So to delay it for until Bashir goes out of the country wouldn't have made sense to a judicial body. So yeah.
That said, as I mentioned, it took them nearly nine months, to come to a decision about the application for an arrest warrant. So it did take them quite a bit longer than other applications for arrest warrants that the prosecutor had requested. But I would agree.
Yeah, I can just sure, add something to this question. I'm not a person who has knowledge about law, but I have been to The Hague for NGOs meeting, and the same question was being asked to prosecutor himself and his member of his team. And they responded that they have two like different strategies of issuing the arrest warrant and implementing the arrest. And in some cases, they can issue the arrest under seal. People were asking, why don't, instead of announcing it and obviously retaliating against people and creating a lot of challenges that we are now facing. And they said, in both cases, like, you need, if you are issuing the arrest under seal, you need also to have countries that can cooperate. Then in case he came to any country, that country is supposed to cooperate and then arrest him. In that case, like in many cases, some like foreign ministers saying if he came for a diplomatic reason, they cannot, because this is like in their agreement between countries. So that's why maybe based on their strategy, they announce it this way.
Thank you. In the back.
Now that the arrest warrant is public, just in terms of practicalities of enforcing it, I know that like, in normal common law context, if there's an arrest warrant for a violent felon whom the police believe may pose a further danger to the public, they can, if necessary, use deadly force to stop the flight of this person. In a similar vein, would we be able to build a legal argument to some state actor, say one that rhymed with Schmashmerica, if state actor wanted to say something like, Mr. President al-Bashir, you can either surrender to a country that will transport you to the ICC, or we will bomb your presidential building in Khartoum until you decide otherwise. Could you make a legally colorable argument on that along the lines of, you know, this is a fleeing violent felon who intends to commit further acts of incredible violence, or would that not work?
What do you think governs intervention in the domestic affairs of another country?
Well, obviously, the UN Charter constrains us from acting from acts of aggressive war. But the question is, could we spin the argument, this isn't aggressive war, this is us, you know, treating Bashir like any other violent criminal who's fleeing law enforcement and intends to commit further violent acts?
It's an interesting argument, but what do you think would be the consequences, the ramifications, perhaps on your own country, on an alleged criminal in our own country, by other states? I mean, what are the longer-term consequences of trying to push that kind of argument?
Well, if this hypothetical country of Shmoshmerica had overwhelming military advantages over other states, they wouldn't need to worry about precisely analogous conduct. But I see your point.
If I may add just one thing. I mean, remember, he's not found guilty.
Right.
What the three judges say is that there are reasonable grounds to go after him. If he is arrested, decide himself to go to The Hague, then there will be a session for the confirmation of the evidence against him. So right now, he is innocent and proven guilty. We know that that there are ample evidence against him. He's, after all, the head of the state. He's also the head of the army. The army was involved in a lot of bombing against Darfurians. There are enough evidence to go after him. But still, in a court of law, there is still a need to confirm the evidence that is against him. Right now, all the three judges said is that there is reasonable evidence that what the Sil from Ocampo, at least on the two counts, the crimes against humanity and crimes of war, that there is enough evidence to arrest him.
Another hand.
Something to,
yes, please.
Like in terms of what he said, like now the car have done their work because it's legal, it's not political, but it's still the member state of the UN Security Council. They have the role to play to put pressure on al-Bashir or Sudan government to cooperate with the Kurds. And this is starting with like I'm not allowing him to travel. Such countries like now I know that he will not go to Ethiopia for African Union summit, and it is a challenge of he may be able to go to Qatar, but also if he's not going, that would be one of the pressure on him and or his government to try to rethink how they can come up with, like, they have a president that no one will accept to deal with him. And there's so many other countries that they said they cannot deal with authority as a state president. So we, like, there is a lot of homework need to be done, need a mobilization among African countries at least to have their strong position. I know that some African countries are cooperating, but some other countries are still backing al-Bashir, but some of them are now revising their position because it's difficult to come publicly as individual country and deal with somebody who's identified to be. But people like you and civil society, human rights activists, they need to do more mobilization and advocacy to encourage these countries to take a strong position against dealing with, because we are trying to pursue justice, and this a new norm. People traditionally they think of always going toward making peace, because that is not giving a lot of responsibilities to these people, because when there is peace agreement, so the internal country has to deal with that. It's difficult, but it's not impossible.
But there is enough pressure right now. I mean, Qatar, just this is inside information, Qatar now doesn't want him to come. They made it clear that they are just looking for ways of telling him don't show up. So they are looking for ways of, at least if they can scare him. You know, they're using the argument there is an American base right there in Qatar. So if they can scare the hell out of him not to show up, that's great. And for the sake of not weakening the ICC, it's great if they can ground him in Sudan and not have him leave anywhere, go anywhere.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a short question for Professor Orandrika, actually, but I'll make it a short comment, and maybe other panelists can share their views as well. It's about the immunity, which is always an issue, these kind of things. But I have the feeling that sometimes we are overcomplicating things a little bit, because, I mean, I understand that immunity has some point with some incumbent officials, but this is actually that's what the international court is for, that's the best way to deal with these kind of issues, as already the ICJ said in the arrest warrant case. So I think like the correct reading of the Rome Statute is that the state parties actually waived the immunities of any officials for prosecutions, and inevitably also for arrest warrant, otherwise it wouldn't have any meaning. But I think this obviously, Sudan is not a state party, but the case was referred by the Security Council, so I actually think that a very analogous argument can be made. So if the case was referred by the Security Council, ICC has jurisdiction, so they must also inevitably waive any immunity for that. And moreover, under the resolution, under the referral resolution, the Sudan has got an obligation to fully cooperate with the ICC. So I think also an argument can be made that it cannot claim the immunity for its president, because the immunity doesn't actually belong to Bashir, but it belongs to the state, as Sudan is a state. So
I think she would suggest that that's probably the strongest argument, as Professor Arnliger was outlining, that the language of the resolution itself in requiring the cooperation of Sudan might limit the argument of immunity successfully.
But it is creating problems. I mean, because there is no precedent where you went after and arrested a sitting president. So it is with, I mean, I've heard this with
Milosevic.
Yes,
Milosevic
and Taylor.
But he was not arrested when he was still
president. He was indicted as a sitting head of state.
But he was arrested after.
After.
Yeah. So it is a concern. I mean, I've heard from lawyers arguing both sides of the coin. So.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I'm saying. Sometimes lawyers overcomplicate.
Yes, in the front.
I had a question that's more about internal Sudanese politics, I guess, and less international legal strategy. But I was wondering what the dynamics are within the Sudanese government. Would the policies of the Sudanese government, as they are conducted under President Bashir, continue without him? Do we have a sense of what his circle is like and what the rest of his government is like? Do we have a sense of whether, if he's removed from the picture, either by being arrested or by being killed by Shamir Shmerica or whatever, if Omar Bashir is no longer president, no longer operating, is there a sense that, I mean, of course it would weaken the government, but would it continue, would these policies continue nonetheless, or is he such a strong force that without him they would negotiate and they would change their policies?
There is a lot going on among the National Congress Party itself. They were negotiating about best case scenario and worst case scenario. If we can allow to get a deferral, let us do our best to get that deferral, because they know that there is other people, it's not only al-Bashir, but there is other people who are guilty and committed crime. Our responsibility is about the crime committed in Darfur. So that make it harder for some, like, this is two groups. Some of them, they are saying, trying to cooperate with the Kurd and to allow themselves at least to ask al-Bashir to stay aside, and then they can continue as a party to maintain their position within the political arena. And there is other group who are very close to al-Bashir and trying to maintain this position and be crazy, like this day is supporting humanitarian. But that doesn't work, even make the situation worse and put them in a more critical situation. But there is potential division among them, and there is some group who are suggesting cooperation with the court.
Within the Congress party, there are elements in the hierarchy that are concerned, because they have been involved in crimes as well. So they are coalescing around Bashir. This is within the party, the governing party. But within Sudan, there is definitely a movement within Sudan that would like to see this group gone, and think that Sudan can have a fresh start and can move in the right directions. One of the arguments that was made by some of the parties against the CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, then was that it brought just two parties to the table, the Congress Party and SPLM, and that that was a mistake, that it should have brought all the political parties in Sudan, because then it would isolate the Congress party. It didn't. I think it was a mistake that was made by people that pushed, that felt that there is a chance for peace, and you should go after it.
Thank you. I had a question. One, I know from the especially Western media, I understand in Europe in particular, it was very important to emphasize that the was genocide, and that it was Arab people killing black people or Muslim people attacking Christian people. But it's interesting that after all of that, you know, very, very heavy media emphasis on an ethnic element or a religious element, the genocide is not in the charge of the indictment. And I just really wanted to know, how would you define the nature of the violence of the conflict? Is it crimes against humanity? Is it war crimes? Is it simply terrorizing a civilian community? You know, should genocide be in the indictment or not?
Let me just clarify that, that genocide was part of what the prosecutor asked the court to issue the arrest warrant for, but the court refused to add it. So the court has issued a warrant for war crimes and crimes against humanity, but not for genocide. Nevertheless, the prosecutor is appealing that, and the court has indicated, even the majority, there was a split in the opinion, 2-1, and there was a dissenting judge who felt that there was enough evidence to meet the threshold of reasonable grounds to believe genocide, that Bashir was responsible for genocide. So there was, you know, it's not that it hasn't come into play. It may, in fact, come into play again, either through the appeal or through the presentation of further evidence by the prosecutor to the court. But nevertheless, your question is
curious about, how do people from Darfur or Sudanese
as in your question, the conflict is really the government backs the Arab tribes against African tribes. And it's really true. This is fact. Even though there's some Arab groups that is not participating in what's going on in Darfur. But basically, those home fights in the side of Sudan government and backed by Sudan government are Arab. And those home targeted are African people. And in many cases, that people asking you about your tribe and identify you either to be killed or to be let free. This happened a lot. Like my brother-in-law, he's a light-skinned guy. They were trying to kill him, and another person jumped and said, no, he is an Arab. And they said, no, he's not an Arab. They said, no, his mom is not an Arab, but his father is. And then they let him free. So that, like, in many cases. And when they raping women, asking them that be happy, you would be giving birth to an Arab son or daughter. Like that, it's like really this is the type of the conflict. For me, I believe it's genocide by definition. What is going on in Darfur? It's a genocide. And as my colleague here mentioned, that it's not enough evidence. And I think the judges were there concerned about not issuing arrest about charges that they don't have enough evidence, and they're avoiding because the situation of Darfur is very critical and facing a lot of challenges. They don't want to jeopardize the court. They're trying to give a chance to get more evidence so that they can be in a strong position. And still there is a chance, I think, and we will work hard to prove that it is a genocide.
Try to add to both comments. The panel decided that it didn't decide that genocide didn't happen. Only decided that there is the evidence presented to them didn't rise to reasonable ground to say to issue the arrest based on genocide grounds. Having said that, I mean, Ocampo is going to go back. He's appealing. He's going to go back with other evidence. This issue of genocide is extremely complicated, and I was there for over a year, and I really don't know. I was there when the commission, the UN Human Rights Commission, that was headed by Judge Antonio Cassisi came there, and they conducted fact-finding missions on the three capitals of Darfur, in Jenina, Niala, and El-Fasher. And they came back and said there is not enough evidence to say that a genocide took place. And that's what was in the report that went to the UN Secretary General. They say that there is enough ground to go after some elements within the Congress Party on war crimes and crimes against humanity, but there is not enough evidence to go after them on genocide grounds. Did this happen or not happen? I don't know. I mean, I was there. I was conducting fact-finding missions, meeting with people on in the camps, in the three Darfurs, and asking questions, and it's hard to say. Genocide also, as an accusation, is very hard to prove. I mean, you have to prove the intent of going after an ethnic group or a religious group or and trying to wipe them out. And they don't know if this is going to be a possibility or not. So we'll see.
Last question, because we're back 5 minutes over. Yes.
Well, I have a question. The issue of enforcement probably is a good thing to probably end with anyway. I don't think the indictment is anywhere in the way of peace at all. Going back, in July, don't you think the ICC could have picked a couple more heads of states or you know, that could have, you know, qualified as Bashir, just to avoid, you know, avoid embarrassment and not politicize the whole issue and all sum them up together and have three or four issues at the same time? Don't you think that would actually facilitate? First of all, I can think of a couple other heads of state that could qualify definitely with Bashir, you know, and put them all together. And that would actually facilitate and it would probably increase the credibility for to prosecute him and make sure that we ensure enforcement.
Yeah, I'm not sure what heads of state you're talking about in particular, but there
are only four.
There are only four situations before the court that the court is actually investigating. It's not the way in which a case comes or a situation comes before the court is either a referral by a state, a UN Security Council referral like happened in the Darfur situation, or an investigation from Prope Muto that's initiated by the prosecutor himself and is approved by the court. So it's sort of, there's a limited world. Like, again, I don't know which head of states you're talking about.
Well, they don't have to be heads of states either. But think or not, Bashir would probably legitimize what others are doing. That's probably my problem at the end.
With respect to your strategy, the problem is there are four situations. The prosecutor has indicted or charged people from every one of those situations. Not the only one, the only head of state is from Sudan, Darfur. But he has in Uganda indicted LRA leaders, Lord's Resistance Army leaders. In the DRC, there are four people who have been indicted, three of which are in the dock. And in the CAR, we have one person who's been indicted, and Jean-Claude Bemba, who's in the dock. So, they, you know, it's not that the court is only focusing on this situation. They have three other situations and cases before the court. But, of course, they're limited in terms of what they can do.
Because the guys,
there's an argument that was made in Gaza, for example, where you have the Minister of Justice of the Palestinian authorities requesting from Ocampo. I mean, I hear what he's saying, because
requesting
from Ocampo to investigate the crimes committed in Gaza in this past month. He is saying that he's looking at it because the PA is not a country. So he's looking at whether the PA can qualify as a country, which would mean that he can investigate.
At any given time.
But the other part of it is that Security Council is not willing to refer what happened. They're calling for an investigation in Gaza, but they're calling for a limited investigation into the compound, the UN compound, that was hit. Mm-hmm. So the argument that we have been doing, at least in Middle East and North Africa, is that then why aren't you going on, is this a selective kind of justice?
I think at any given time, the prosecutor has before him thousands of submissions from many different places and has to conduct an investigation to see whether or not the particular situation is admissible and can be subject to the jurisdiction of his court. And I think that's what he's indicated so far in this case, as well as in Colombia and some other Ivory Coast. You know, he has some other countries under watch and a unit within his office that is charged with investigating.
He's ultimately looking at these cases would actually help the ICC for more credibility, and it would just prevent, you know, undermining their work. Absolutely, the indictment is, I mean, a source of hope and excitement that if he's guilty, he should be. But equally, equal justice is probably, I mean, helps the case itself, not just because of the sake of equal justice.
Right. The issue is resources to some extent and time. I just want to give, is there an opportunity? Do you want to?
Yeah, maybe there is, like, I expect it to be asked a question about, we also have some from the four opposition leaders, they are implicated in the crime, like, it's not the same as government, but say the attack on Castaneda, and when the idea of going after them came out, all that four are in agreement. For the sake of justice, they don't care. Or whoever he is, they should go and face, and they are working very hard to have them cooperate with the court, either by surrender themselves, or they will facilitate for the court to arrest them by any means, because we want to establish a base for justice in Sudan, and that we have to be the first who pay, like, to bring ourselves to that level. And regarding your last question, we have argued about the case. There are so many other countries that there is some crime committed against civilians. But there is a challenge of, if the country is not a member state of the ICC, the prosecutor cannot go in. And the case of Darfur is just unique because it was referred by the UN Security Council. But the UN Security Council has weakness also. That's why Darfur is still pending up to, because there is some countries that are playing interest with other, like, leaders, like, I mean, China, Russia, continue to obstruct. Like, it wasn't even come into this stage to refer to the court. It was being, like, supposed to be solved earlier, but they continue to pass Sudan government. And that is maybe the case with so many other countries. And that is why people need, like, to raise awareness of the ordinary people, and then people can be able to pressure their leaders to either to be a member of the court or to be, like, to stand in the UN Security Council to help bring these cases to.
Please help me in thanking our panelists.